Growing up, I thought Toledo was a big city. Having been raised in a small rural town outside of Oberlin, Ohio, where our neighbors were spread far apart and my high school's graduating class was half that of most cities, Toledo was the place I spread my wings to fly to, not from. Of course, now that I've lived in Toledo for over a decade, my world's been expanded. I've also come to see this city for what it truly is, both its opportunities and its challenges. And yet, I don't think I've lost the wide-eyed wonder I once had for this city. As I've grown and matured, it's changed right along with me. For the first 7 weeks of our show, you heard the story of Samuel Chang, one of our founders, and how his journey led him first to Toledo, then the East Coast, and then to Toledo again. In the following few weeks of this show, you'll be hearing from some other members of the Midstory team. We'll be sharing our story of what brought us to Toledo and what we found in the Glass City. I'm Anna Diazio, a data analyst at Midstory, and I'll be your host today. Once I left tiny Henrietta Township to attend college in the great big city of Toledo, I told myself I wanted to change the world. Not everyone in my family had had the chance to go to college, but they always taught me the value of hard work and did everything they could to set me up for success. When I left home, I knew it was my time to fly and bear all the responsibilities that came with it. People often say Toledo's a place where you can be a big fish in a small pond, but the opposite was true for me. Suddenly, my pond was a lot bigger, and I realized I had a lot to learn. Changing the world suddenly seemed extremely naive and sort of impossible. Partway through my graduate degree at Bowling Green State University, I was introduced to Midstory. And suddenly, I felt like I had a way to accomplish what I had come to Toledo to do. I'd had a dream, but that dream needed a landing ground. During the years I spent pursuing my degrees, I learned to be humble. And that humility became an asset to my pursuit in life rather than a disadvantage. Midstory showed me that understanding where we come from can help shape where we want to go, and that being open to learning, growing, and being broadened gives us a renewed sense of home, as well as a renewed desire to make home exactly what we aspire for it to be. Well, to change the world. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. Today, we're going to hear stories of people and moments who could have changed the course of history. Stories about turning points in the Civil War, an Underground Railroad Center, and Detroit's vision to host the Olympics. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home, and likewise learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the first episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, a podcast produced by Reckoning Inc. in collaboration with Ohio Humanities. The Copperhead Conspiracy tells a little-known story from the Civil War about a treasonous Midwestern plot to bring down the Union. Next up is a story about how an unusual-shaped building in Oberlin, Ohio, has been given a new purpose as the Oberlin Underground Railroad Center. Finally, in lieu of the Winter Olympics recently coming to a close, we bring to you a story about Detroit's many past attempts to become a host city. If you enjoy this program, be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. Digging into Civil War history is an interesting story about a group of Northerners who were against President Lincoln's policies and aligned with the Confederate movement to take over certain Midwest states, free Confederate prisoners, and keep slavery legal. Their scheme never succeeded, however, thanks to a Union spy secretly among them. Today, we're bringing you the first episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, a podcast produced by Reckoning Inc. in collaboration with Ohio Humanities. Episode 1 introduces this story and how the conspiracy sparked. Learn more about this podcast at ohiohumanities.org/podcasts.
For many Americans, the events of the past couple of years can seem utterly unprecedented. Few can remember a time when the country was so dramatically polarized. According to the Reuters news agency, in the year leading up to the 2024 presidential election, there were over 300 acts of political violence in the United States, with another 150 in the first 6 months of 2025. This represents the biggest surge in political violence since the early 1970s. And for the first time in decades, we have witnessed several political assassinations in this country, with people across the political spectrum being targeted.
The killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk yesterday at a college in Utah is just the latest in a series of politically motivated violent acts just in recent months.
Investigators say that Vance Belter posed as a police officer and fatally shot former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark around 3.
A gunman opened fire on a Dallas immigration office, killing two detainees and injuring another.
A Pennsylvania man is in custody and charged with setting fire to the governor's mansion in Harrisburg early Sunday morning, after the first night of Passover.
Many have publicly worried that without some form of intervention, we may be headed toward another civil war. But the last civil war in the United States happened so long ago that for most people, it's little more than an abstraction, a unit in high school history class. And when most people do think about the Civil War, they tend to think of it in terms of the South pitted against the North over the issue of slavery, with massive armies fighting each other on now famous battlefields, with names like Gettysburg and Antietam. But 160 years ago, things were incredibly more complicated. There were Southerners who were diametrically opposed to slavery and passionate about maintaining the integrity of the Union. And there were large numbers of Northerners who were extremely unhappy with the call to end slavery and the war that followed. And some of them plotted a massive insurrection with allies in the Confederacy.
And there were these radical groups, sort of similar to the Oath Keepers today or the Proud Boys, called under various names. One of the most famous was Sons of Liberty. Nobody knows how big they are, but they claimed tens of thousands of members. And they will openly start meeting with Confederates to plot a combined assault.
The Confederates in question were soldiers who had escaped from Union prisons and were now living in Canada. Once there, they found like-minded Northerners who had been exiled from the United States for their political beliefs and were more than willing to help thwart Lincoln and the Union Army.
You know, the institutions of American democracy are not as solid as we all hope they would be. And there are some fragile points that a well-committed and organized group of anti-governmental treasonous actors can really target and bring down a government in peacetime, but especially in war.
In the midst of the Civil War, we had a deeply unpopular president in Abraham Lincoln, who had suspended civil liberties and invoked martial law, using as his rationale the threat posed by his political opponents on the national security of the country. Because so much time has passed, it is easy to dismiss the relevance of those times to that of our own. But if you squint just a little bit, you can see the overall shape of many of the same issues we are arguing about today. How powerful should a president be? When should they be able to invoke martial law and imprison Americans without due process? In what way should Congress and the courts intervene when they think a president is behaving badly, against the best interests of the country? What should states do if they disagree profoundly with the policies of the federal government? And what should citizens do if they believe that the country is in danger and that they are not being sufficiently protected by the checks and balances enshrined in the U.S. Constitution? These are precisely the issues that were on the table in the 1860s and again part of our reality in the here and now.
You can't hide the past. The past is with us. And if we don't recognize the truth of the past, then we're not going to understand the truth of today. And if Americans can't grapple with the, frankly, the ugly truth of the Civil War, that Lincoln was an embattled, beleaguered president, that for most of his term, he was hugely unpopular. There were riots against him. There were conspiracies. We have to face the darkness in the mirror and not be afraid to learn the lessons from the past.
What we will be doing over the next 6 episodes of this series is a deep dive into a moment in American history that is little known and little understood, but which has much to teach us about the challenges that bedevil our country right now.
A lot of the people who got swept up in this conspiracy would have told you that what they were doing was the most patriotic act. It was the saving of the Republic, the saving of the Constitution, rather than the rejection of it.
This is The Copperhead Conspiracy. I'm Dan Gediman. The plan that Captain Thomas Hines proposed to President Jefferson Davis in February 1864 was nothing if not audacious. Hines was a well-bred Kentuckian, handsome and smart, with a neatly trimmed mustache and piercing eyes. By the age of 25, he was already a seasoned veteran of John Hunt Morgan's cavalry and had masterminded a daring escape from the Ohio Penitentiary for Morgan and his senior officers. What Hines proposed to Davis was that a small force of Confederate soldiers based in Canada should conspire with large groups of Northern Democrats who were angry with the Lincoln government. Together, they would storm the state capitals of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, remove the governors from power, and take over the states, which would then become allies of the Southern Confederacy. They would also free Confederate soldiers from Northern prisons and arm them with guns and ammunition stolen from state armories. And in this way, the Confederacy would have both the manpower and the political clout to force the Union to cease fighting and allow the South to peacefully coexist as its own nation, a nation where slavery would be forever legal. Davis dismissed Hines' proposal, as it would utilize tactics that he believed chivalrous gentlemen shouldn't use. But 2 months later, a Union officer was killed behind enemy lines. In his pocket were found military papers that appeared to indicate a plan to kill the Confederate leadership and burn down their capital in Richmond, Virginia. The evidence of this Union plot immediately changed Davis's attitude toward clandestine warfare, leading him to greenlight the plan that Thomas Hines had proposed earlier. Before leaving Richmond, Hines was given written orders from the Confederate Secretary of War, outlining his key mission: to connect with Northerners who were furious with President Lincoln.
In passing through the United States, you will confer with the leading persons friendly or attached to the cause of the Confederacy, or who may be advocates of peace, and do all in your power to induce our friends to organize and prepare themselves to render such aid as circumstances may allow, on terms consistent always with the independence of the Confederate States. Respectfully, James A. Seddon, Secretary of War.
The success of Hines' plan would largely depend on him finding a committed force of Northerners willing to take up arms against their own government. And for this, he wouldn't have to look very far. By the summer of 1864, the Civil War had been going on for over 3 years, and hundreds of thousands of Union soldiers had died by then. Many otherwise loyal Northern citizens were tired, worried, and pessimistic about the war effort. Among some members of the Northern Democratic Party, concerns about the war had even escalated to the point that some were willing to use violence to resist what they saw as unconstitutional abuses of power by the Lincoln administration. This was especially true after President Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, one of the oldest concepts in English common law. In practical terms, this meant that Lincoln had decided that, in a time of civil war, many legal norms should be suspended and replaced with martial law. It needs to be said that the Democratic Party of the 1860s was very different from the Democratic Party of today. In many ways, they were more like the present-day Republican Party. They believed in a weak federal government, the primacy of states' rights, and the importance of individual liberty. The peace wing of the Democratic Party were known as Copperheads, partly because they used liberty-head copper pennies as pins to identify themselves, and partly because they were considered as dangerous as a venomous snake. The Copperheads were a diverse group from varied backgrounds, with different things motivating them to take action against the federal government.
The Copperheads fell into three different categories.
Jennifer Weber is a professor of history at the United States Air Force Academy and author of the book, The Copperheads.
Either they were born and grew up in the South, or their parents had emigrated north from a southern state, or they still had family there in the South. The second was immigrants, particularly Catholic immigrants, because they had been vilified both for their religion and for being non-Anglo immigrants by the Know-Nothings in the late 1840s and early 1850s. Many of those Know-Nothings wound up being absorbed into the Republican Party. And so they regarded the Civil War as a Republican war and did not want to have any part in it. The third group is people who were just quite conservative Democrats, people who read the Constitution and understood the Constitution as an inelastic document. And they felt that much of what Lincoln did over the course of the war was unconstitutional.
The very existence of the Copperhead movement during the Civil War is something that has largely been left out, or at least minimized, in most of the American history textbooks used in our schools in the past 50 to 75 years. And few of us, I suspect, learned anything about the depth of anti-Lincoln sentiment among many Northerners, and how violently that dissent was sometimes expressed. Again, Jennifer Weber.
Abraham Lincoln is this hallowed figure now in American history. He routinely tops the list of America's greatest presidents. But in his own time, he wasn't regarded that way at all. Americans in the North were deeply divided about him. And there were Americans who absolutely loathed him. And it wasn't just a handful. There were people who started the war being more or less favorable to Lincoln, and it really helped Lincoln that the Confederates had fired first and initiated the war. But he took a number of steps that people found objectionable. And as time went on, as these decisions piled up, more and more people turned against him.
Among the objectionable actions that President Lincoln took during the war that enraged many Northerners were the Emancipation Proclamation, the establishment of a military draft, and allowing black men to join the Union Army. By 1864, even some of the war's strongest supporters ended up turning against it, and against the leader who was guiding it. One example is Brick Pomeroy, a Wisconsin newspaper publisher and a pro-war Democrat who ended up as one of the nation's most outspoken copperheads.
To the point that by 1864, the summer of 1864 especially, he won't call Lincoln by his name anymore. He only refers to the president as the widowmaker or the orphan maker, and he is openly advocating in the pages of his newspaper for Lincoln's assassination.
From the La Crosse Weekly Democrat, August 24th, 1864. "He who wars against the Constitution of our country is a traitor, and Lincoln is one of these men. And if he is elected to misgovern for another 4 years, we trust some bold hand will pierce his heart with a dagger point for the public good."
Nowhere was the hatred of Lincoln and the Republican Party stronger than within a particularly radical group of Copperhead Democrats who had organized themselves into secret societies, known first as the Knights of the Golden Circle, then the Order of American Knights, and finally as the Sons of Liberty.
The United States, at this time, is awash in fraternal organizations.
Patrick Lewis is the president of the Filson Historical Society in Louisville, Kentucky.
The Knights of the Golden Circle started out a group of private American armies to go into Central and South America and win new lands, conquer new territories from the former Spanish Empire, and bring them into the United States. Of course, all of these were abject failures and usually involved everybody getting lined up in front of firing squads and shot. But a lot of these folks who had managed to make it safely back into the United States sort of formed the Knights of the Golden Circle to further the goals of secession, particularly in places like the Upper South, like Kentucky, but also reaching across the Ohio River into the southern parts of now the Midwest, with the goal of trying to promote this idea of a Midwestern Confederacy. And you see the ways that they sort of incorporate Christian theology, American history, and the defense of liberty, and make them think that what they're doing is not just sort of an anti-patriotic sabotage of an active war effort while their cousins and their brothers and their neighbors are all out literally in the ranks putting their lives on the line, but it's in fact the highest form of patriotism. Their tagline is, "Resistance to tyrants is obedience to God."
One of the things driving these secret societies was a desire to establish something that was then called the Northwest Confederacy. Because the present-day Midwest was at that time the northwestern boundary of the United States. It was a part of the country that, in many ways, had more in common with the South than the states of the Northeast.
So I think that the idea of the Northwest Confederacy kind of goes back to an earlier period of American history before the Market Revolution.
Robert Churchill is a professor of history at the University of Hartford and author of To Shake Their Guns in the Tyrant's Face.
If you go back to the early years of sort of settlements in the Midwest, what you find is the way to get your crops to market is to build a raft and float down the Ohio and then float down the Mississippi River. In other words, basically all of the Midwest's economic ties are with the South. And so there is this idea among some folks in the Midwest that the South is the natural ally, that the Midwest has more in common with the South than it does with the industrialized Puritan Northeast. And hence that the Midwest really doesn't belong in the Union, that the Midwest's true affiliation is with the South. The problem is the vast majority of folks in the Midwest don't agree with that. But there is a small faction of folks in the sort of Copperhead faction of the Democratic Party who cling to that idea that the thing that they have to do is to organize this sort of mass anger and resistance at the draft and anger at emancipation. And if they can harness that, then they can stage an uprising and they can break the Midwestern states away from the Union and probably in the process stop the war dead in its tracks.
For the Confederates, this movement toward a Northwest Confederacy was deeply attractive, as they were actively seeking ways to pressure the United States beyond the battlefield. And so, a conspiracy emerged between the Confederate government and the leadership of these Copperhead secret societies in the North.
By the second half of 1864, there will be three currents that begin to merge, which will eventually lead to the conspiracy.
Julian Schur is a journalist and the author of The North Star, Canada and the Civil War Plots Against Lincoln.
First of all, you have growing numbers of Confederates who are prisoners in northern prisons quite close to the Canadian border, something like 215,000 prisoners. And the Confederate agents in Canada were eager to storm these prisons and free these prisoners. In fact, John Wilkes Booth, his plot to kidnap Lincoln, that was his first idea. His whole idea was to kidnap Lincoln to force the Union to free tens of thousands of Confederate prisoners. The second thing you have is this widespread dissatisfaction in the Northwest states from Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri. There was a sense among the Confederates that there was a willingness among the people to overthrow these governments. The third factor you had is the Democratic Party was holding its convention to name its leader who would take on Abraham Lincoln. And one of the plots was to have basically a takeover of the Democratic Party by the most Copperhead sympathizers that they could find. And the man who crystallized all these three currents, the prisoners held in northern jails by the Union, the dissatisfaction in the Northwest, and the political takeover of the Democratic Party, was a man named Clement Vallandigham.
Vallandigham was a Democratic congressman from Dayton, Ohio. He was one of the strongest critics of Abraham Lincoln in the North, giving stem-winding speeches on the floor of Congress that condemned the president for his various wartime policies.
I have denounced from the beginning the usurpations and the infractions, one and all, of law and constitution by the president and those under him. Their repeated and persistent arbitrary arrests, the suspension of habeas corpus, the violation of freedom of the mails, of the private house, of the press and of speech, and all the other multiplied wrongs and outrages upon public liberty and private right, which have made this country one of the worst despotisms on earth for the past 20 months. And I will continue to rebuke and denounce them to the end.
Vallandigham was a three-term Ohio representative and was one of the most forceful leaders of the Copperheads. He denounced Lincoln, this is his words, for having plunged the country into a cruel and bloody and unnecessary war. And he railed against what he called the enslavement of the white race by debt and taxes and arbitrary power. And finally, he said, if standing against Lincoln means ending this war, he said, I am all over and altogether a pro-slavery man. Well, Lincoln was getting more than a little upset at this very powerful orator and leader.
Lincoln considered Vallandigham a danger to the nation, and he would eventually be expelled from the United States for his treasonous rhetoric. But that anti-Lincoln rhetoric was music to the ears of the Confederate leadership in Richmond. And by the late spring of 1864, Vallandigham, living in exile in Canada, was regularly meeting with both Confederate Captain Thomas Hines and Jacob Thompson, one of three commissioners sent to Canada by President Jefferson Davis. Hines and Thompson were actively looking for Copperheads they could collaborate with on Hines' proposal to topple the Midwestern state governments. By this time, Vallandigham had become Grand Commander of the Sons of Liberty, and he promised Hines and Thompson that he could muster thousands of the Secret Order's members to take direct action against their shared foes. Hines reported on his conversations with Vallandigham and Thompson in a June 1864 report sent to the Confederate Secretary of War.
The Confederates in Canada are to gather with two regiments in the process of formation at Chicago, which will be placed under my command to move upon that place for the release of prisoners confined to Camp Douglas. Simultaneous with this movement, the Democrats in every county of Illinois and portions of Indiana and Ohio will rally to arms. A force of 3,000 Democrats under a competent leader will march upon Rock Island for the release of the 7,000 prisoners held there. 5,000 will move upon Indianapolis, where there are 6,000 prisoners. The remainder will concentrate upon Chicago and Springfield. The state governments of Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois will be seized and their executive heads disposed of. By this means, we hope to have, in the days after the movement has begun, a force of 50,000 men.
How did things get to this point, where Northern citizens were angry enough at the federal government, during a time of war, to conspire with agents of an enemy government to take up arms against it?
For some Americans, they felt that it was rigged. They felt that it wasn't legitimate. And they didn't really accept Lincoln as their president.
That's next time on the Copperhead Conspiracy. The Copperhead Conspiracy is a production of Reckoning, Inc., with funding and scholarly assistance from Ohio Humanities. It was produced and narrated by me, Dan Gediman. Our historical consultant was Dr. Stephen Rockenbach. Voice actors were Alec Voles and Barrett Cooper. Our theme music was composed by Ja'Cory Arthur, with other music licensed from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Nina Ellis, Louisville Public Media, and to Loretta Williams for editorial guidance. Major support for this series was provided by Archon Construction. Additional support from Jay and Susan Giles, Doreen Yuha Sauer, Lopa Mehrotra, and Douglas and Marissa Brown. Many thanks to Jennifer Weber, Patrick Lewis, Robert Churchill, and Julian Schur, whose interviews were heard in this episode. Please note that the views expressed by Jennifer Weber do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force Academy, the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. If you would like to support our nonprofit organization and unlock bonus episodes of this series, you can do so at patreon.com/reckoningradio. Our first bonus episode explains all the key events in American history that led to the Civil War. You can access that and more at patreon.com/reckoningradio. For transcripts, a bibliography, and other content related to this series, please visit our website at copperheadconspiracy.org. Thanks so much for listening. Please join us next time for another episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy.
If you're just now joining us, you're currently listening to the Midstory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org or WGTE.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's next story is part of Withstanding, a mini-documentary series and exhibition featuring six adaptive reuse projects from across Ohio. From bustling North Columbus to quiet King's Mills, from Northeast Ohio's Cleveland and Oberlin to the glass capital of the world, Toledo, join us as we uncover stories of Ohioans' creativity and innovation. These sites, ranging from schools to warehouses to factories, reflect how our past has been shaped by the forces of industry, migration, education, and more. And their transformation shows how Ohioans are reimagining the future of our state's built heritage. In the city of Oberlin, not too far from the local bike path that I grew up riding on with my family, is an unusual-looking cylindrical building. Why cylindrical? When it was built in 1889, it was shaped as a sign of industrial progress. Its interior made to store gas that would be used for illuminating the city's streets and heating its homes. Today, it no longer houses gas, but it illuminates the city in a different way. Now, as a cultural center, the building sheds light on Oberlin's abolitionist history and heritage. Here is that story.
How would you even begin building a roof like this? And perhaps more importantly, why? The first answer involves workers delicately balancing a few rafters against one another to create this beautiful conical shape. The second answer is a little more complicated, one that involves coal gas, street lamps, and eventually the story of the Underground Railroad.
Those people who have lived in Oberlin for a long time have watched this project languish and then be revitalized. And the people in the community were just overjoyed to come inside because they said, thought you'd never finish.
The roundhouse was built in 1889, and though features like the ceiling are beautiful, it was strictly utilitarian.
So it was built by the Oberlin, I have to check, Oberlin Gas Lighting Company, because it changes its name later. Gas production was used for lighting and fuel. So this structure was built in the later 1800s, and it's called a gas holder, which is literally what it did. Inside there are two structures. There's like the brick exterior. There is another layer beneath that. And when gas is pumped into there, there is a metal bell. So the gas is somewhat sandwiched between the water and the bell, and it keeps it at a constant pressure to feed out of the building. And the structure, you know, it wasn't built to be a storage basement. It was built specifically for that industrial purpose.
After less than 30 years in use, the gas holder building shuttered and has remained vacant for nearly a century. It stands as the last brick structure of its kind west of the Appalachian Mountains and has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1998.
There was this gap of it just being there, and most community members, they kind of lost the memory of what it was for in the first place. Around the 1990s, the owner, he was thinking about that shopping center and what else could go there. There were other community members who spoke up at the time, concerned about this area and weighing in on what they would like to see preserved and what they would like to see happen to it.
Kenny Clark himself told me this. He said he had the bulldozer up to that wall right there, and somebody from the city had came and stopped him and said, possibly talk to him about donating it to the city. And that's when this project really began.
The gas holder building is now being transformed into the Oberlin Underground Railroad Center, a community gathering place and transportation hub that honors Oberlin's deep ties to the anti-slavery movement.
I didn't remember much about African American history courses when I was in school. It probably was taught, but it wasn't something that was really highlighted or anything that I really paid attention to at the time. But now that I've gotten older and I know more about my family history, it's really changed my perspective on knowing the history of the walls.
In 1858, a group of Oberlin residents and students successfully rescued John Price, a freedom seeker living in Oberlin, from slave catchers in the nearby town of Wellington. Nancy Wall's ancestor, OSB Wall, was among them.
They were told that they weren't supposed to do what they did, and they didn't care. So they went ahead and they helped rescue other people. To know that we have something for the Black community to share their stories, to share their history, to share what's really important to us in this town means a lot to me. And it's been a long time coming.
There we go. I can pull this all the way out if you want, and you can just walk down.
I'll come down.
All right. A little dusty. Of course, these are original bricks. They're made to admit water, so that was one of the hardest parts. As you see, this is the normal water line right here. Before we started this project, there was about this much water here at all times. And this is the original floor right here. And it was that thin, it was just riveted. Something you would see on a boiler or something, you know, just a riveted steel. This was definitely a labor of love for me.
You see that through a lot of the records that, yes, it was a historic building and this is a very important history story to be telling, but it was also about bringing community together and especially for African American community members telling their stories, celebrating together, celebrating their accomplishments. So it's not just about the past, but it's what can be done today and leading us into the future.
One of my visions was to have a North Star, you know, up in the rafters, because that's where how the slaves moved. They always look for the North Star. And that's something that people say now, you know, when you want to do something extravagant, you know, look to the North Star.
We call it the Underground Railroad Center, but the history is not so much about slavery. It's all about progress. You know, when we had streetlights that were lit by gas, that's a part of what happened because of this building. So Oberlin has so many historic things here, and I just, anybody who's coming in here, I want them to feel welcome and to know this is a part of Oberlin's history.
This story was adapted for audio from one of our documentaries. If you would like to watch the video version of this piece, as well as the documentaries for the other five sites featured in this project, visit midstory.org/with-standing. Withstanding is funded in part by the America 250 Ohio Commission and the Ohio Arts Council. This project is also supported in part by the Arts Commission and the City of Toledo and Lucas County. Mark your calendars for Saturday, April 11th for the largest regional pickleball tournament held at the University of Toledo, the Toledo Pickleball Classic and Career Futures Expo. The event is free and open to the public and will feature tournaments across corporate teams, UToledo student orgs, and local high schoolers, a Career Futures Expo with 80-plus companies looking for the next round of talent, and a community carnival with bouncy houses, a free kids pickleball clinic, food trucks, and more. Visit ToledoPickleballClassic.org for more info. In 1936, the city of Detroit had a dream to host the Olympics. That year, Detroit was gaining a reputation in the sports scene. Their major teams and athletes were winning championships, placing them at the top in the country. But what seemed like a promising beginning did not lead to a smooth road or immediate win. Summer intern Martin Barreto shares with us the rest of the story and talks with fellow Evan Blanco about Detroit's 30-year pursuit of this dream.
I wrote a story about Detroit's failed attempts to host the Olympics and how that failure reflected larger truths about the city as a whole.
Okay, that's really interesting. What got you interested in this story?
Well, my mom is from Detroit, actually. I have a lot of family in Detroit, and I've been there a lot. And my mom would always tell me these stories about her time in the city and like how much it's changed over the years and the roller coaster ups and downs of its progression. And I had never really given it any serious thought until I found this framework of the Olympics.
Okay, so tell me, why did Detroit want to host the Olympics so bad?
Detroit wanted to host the Olympics so bad for a couple of reasons. The first reason was that they were just really, really into sports in the mid to late 1930s. They felt that they were the city of champions. They had this, their sports teams were really good. The Red Wings won titles. The Tigers were really good. They had this championship boxer that was from Detroit. And also the economy of the city was like doing really, really well. Like they were beginning to prosper. They were like the second biggest city in the country behind New York.
Okay. So I recall you had read a few books to research this piece. Can you tell me about those books and what did you learn from them?
The main book was by David Moranis. It's called Once in a Great City. And my grandma actually gave me this book, and she lived in Detroit for a long time. And she was like, you know, if there's ever you know, a book that tells like a good picture of Detroit's history in, you know, the 20th century, it's this one. The book had these like broad strokes about things in Detroit, but it too prioritized the Olympic bids as they related to other things that were going on at the time, because just like infrastructurally, when you're trying to get the Olympics for 30 years, you have to be building things in the city that can support potentially having the Olympics for 30 years. So yeah, they had these plans to like renovate the state fairgrounds, and they had this great, like, they had such a strong, like, resource of blue collar workers that were willing to like do the kind of construction work that would propel like big grand Olympic buildings. And they were so ready to use that stuff over and over and over and over. And that's what this book kind of talked a lot about as it related to like Ford and GM and the like eventual white flight out of the city, and the civil unrest that happened in the late 60s and early 70s was very connected to this grand Olympic attempt.
So reading your article is really fascinating to learn about the president of the IOC that at the time that was born in Detroit. Can you tell me a bit more about him and his role in this story?
Basically, he was this Olympic athlete who was a prominent member of the Amateur Athletic Association, the AAU, and kind of rose the ranks there. He was like a gritty, like self-made man. Like he had this kind of rags to riches story where he was poor and then he like became this great athlete. And then he made this like business with, I think it was construction or glass or steel or something like that. So not only did he have like vast amounts of prowess among the athletic community, he also had vast amounts of like resources and money. In like the 20s and the 30s, he rose the ranks of the International Olympic Committee and eventually became the president, I think in the 50s or 60s. But by then he was this like business magnate, basically. And so during World War II, he had so much like influence that he would go to Germany like frequently. And he was pretty chummy with a lot of the high ranking like Nazi officials. And the particularly interesting, I think, part of his life as it relates to the Olympics is this Jesse Owens debacle, where Jesse Owens goes to the Olympics in 1936 in Germany and wins everything. And, you know, as a black man, totally stripped down like the Nazis' ideals of like white superiority and white supremacy. Basically, this IOC president got in this sort of petty dispute with Jesse Owens about the amount of money that Jesse Owens could make, because he had done this great, you know, service to his country, won all these gold medals, and basically got paid nothing for it. Meanwhile, Avery Brundage, this IOC president, was like making lots and lots of money on the backs of the American athletes that were performing so well. And after this dispute, Brundage kicked him off of the American Olympic team, and he never competed for America again, despite winning 4 medals in the Olympics. And then Jesse Owens was forced to do like these kind of humiliating like circus acts where he would like race against horses, or he would like compete with animals or something like that. And that reality for Owens was largely due to Avery Brundage, who was a known bigot and anti-Semite. And the ironic thing about that is that there were 4 Axis powers in World War II. Mm-hmm. Germany, Japan, Italy, and Finland was actually also in the Axis powers. A lot of people don't know that. But all 4 of those countries got to host the Olympics before America or Detroit ever did. And that was when Avery Brundage was the president of the International Olympic Committee.
So he was kind of the main gatekeeper, deciding whether Detroit could be the host or not. Can you tell me about kind of our main hero in the story who was trying to get Detroit to host the Olympics and kind of that last chance he had?
Yeah, you're talking about Fred Mattai Sr., who in these 30 plus years of Detroit trying to get the Olympics, he was the president of the Detroit Olympic Committee. And he made it his life's work to get Detroit into the Olympics. He had this very similar sort of come up to Avery Brundage in which he was this another self-made man, very rugged, former athlete in the American Athletic Association. I don't think he quite got to the Olympics, but he was a prominent like track and field guy in American sports. Ended up getting like a lot of wealth in Detroit, being this business magnate. And he worked and worked and worked for 30 years alongside Avery Brundage to try and get the Olympics to Detroit. This last attempt that he made in 1963, to take part in the 1968 games was his best yet. They were like at kind of the peak of their powers culturally. They had all this Motown stuff going on. Ford and GM were still big. America had kind of finished suburbanizing. So like the car industry was massive. The flight out of Detroit and into the suburbs had begun, but there was still all this power in the factories. And Michigan as a state were like, okay, we're going to pump lots and lots of money to Mattai Sr. We're going to give him like millions of dollars, and we're going to give him like thousands of people on this committee to try and get the Olympics.
This is the time to do it.
Yeah. This was the perfect time to do it. And he knew, he was like in his 70s at the time, so he knew that this was his last chance. And so he assembled this huge, massive proposal. The proposals that he had before were these kind of book, like pamphlet things that showed off Detroit and like what they had and what they could read. Instead, this time he made this... it was like two whole tables full of like these little sort of statues and these like, what do you call them? Like mock-ups models of the city, basically. Yeah. Like models of the city. And where the Olympic Stadium would be. And it was this very beautiful, grand thing. And then he had this very American presentation where like John F. Kennedy was there. And it was like playing this like American rock music. And it was like showing off all the cool stuff about Detroit. And everybody in the room, from the reports that I read from Once in a Great City, the David Moranis book, all the reporters, even the European ones, thought that Detroit was going to win. The delegates from every country go into the voting chamber to discuss and to decide, and they come out, and they give Mexico City the bid, and that was the nail in the coffin. That was like the heartbreak moment. They bid again, I think, the following year for the 74 Olympics, but Fred Mattai wasn't involved in that one, and they had no money left, and the momentum was really kind of gone for Detroit getting the Olympics. And that was kind of this moment where everybody in Detroit, including the mayor, was so invested in this thing, and then it failed. And during this time, there were protests going on, and Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X were very involved in Detroit and in their like predominantly black churches and in their communities. This was again the time of suburbia, so a lot of these urban communities were getting like literally bulldozed over to make highways so that people could flee the city and go to the suburbs. And what's ironic about that is the car industry needed the suburbs and Detroit needed the car industry, but the suburbs were what was destroying like the infrastructure of Detroit. You know what I mean? So it was this kind of catch 22 where like the snake was eating its own tail. And the reaction to losing the Olympic bid specifically was reflective of the kind of explosiveness that was occurring in Detroit during that time.
So last question. I know last summer when you were writing this piece, this was definitely a labor of love. You spent a lot of time on this. And I know you had to cut out a lot from the story. Are there any interesting stories or tidbits that, you know, you didn't have the space to include, but...
Yeah, originally this was, I was going to structure it like a Greek play, like a Greek drama, where it was like five acts and the chorus would say things and it was like very like fancy. And then I took it to you know, the editor and they were like, this just isn't what journalism is. Like, this is not what we do here. And I was like, okay, so I had to cut it down. But I think that made it a lot better. One interesting piece of the puzzle that I had to cut out was that the Cold War was also going on during that time. The place that the delegates went to vote on who got the Olympics was in Baden-Baden, Germany, which is like very kind of small town. And the schism between East Germany and West Germany and like the Western powers and the Eastern powers, and a lot of the delegates didn't want that tension to spill over into the international games. And there was precedent for it, too. There were a couple hockey games that, or hockey tournaments that took place in America that Russians and some of the Germans weren't allowed to attend. And the Olympic Committee didn't want that to spill over into, you know, the greatest sporting event ever, the Olympics. So that was like another factor that played into this where, you know, Brundage had all this control and all this power. And, you know, he admitted that he didn't want Detroit to get the Olympics. Mm-hmm. But there was a real international schism that didn't work in Detroit's favor, and in fact worked in Mexico City's favor, because there had never been a Spanish-speaking country or Latin American country to host the Olympics. And so they were like, we want to take politics all the way out of it and give it to Mexico City, which was kind of ironic because there were a lot of protests and there was political things going on in Mexico City in that time too. Like, you can't really avoid that sort of stuff. But I think that it goes to show the intertwining between sports and reality.
Well, awesome. Well, someday I hope that you'll still be able to write your Greek tragedy about Detroit. You know, it might have not been the forum this time to do it, but hopefully in the future. And thanks for your reporting, Marty.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Midstory Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Midstory, our home, and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. The Midstory Hour is a Midstory podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted and written by me, Anna Diazio, and edited by Evan Blanco. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. This week's episode featured stories by the Greater Midstory team, including Ruth Chang, Martin Barreto, and Evan Blanco. Midstory is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Midstory re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at midstory.org.